Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Hello. Welcome to this, the third episode of Realpolitik. I am your host, Firas Modad. In the previous episode, we had gone over some of the history of the State of Israel, reaching, I think, up to the Oslo Accords. Maybe before we begin, we can do a quick little recap on where we were. So the State of Israel was founded in 1948. The intention behind it was for Britain to have a foothold in the Middle East, close to the Suez Canal, and that could separate Egypt and Syria and prevent the emergence of a unified Arab state that could become a threat in the Mediterranean. There was a long list of wars, 1956, 1967, 1973. The Arabs pretty much lost all of these wars, and what this led to was the rise of Palestinian militancy through leftist groups as well as secular groups that were trying to basically find a way to force the Israelis to recognize the Palestinians and to find a way to end the State of Israel. In 1979, the Egyptians figured that they couldn't beat Israel and that their economy couldn't continue with endless wars, so they signed a peace treaty with Israel, and the result of that was the assassination of the president who had signed the peace treaty in 1981, but the Egyptian military continued with its plan to make peace and exit the Arab-Israeli conflict, and this led Israel to return the Sinai Peninsula to Egypt, and it led to the peace treaty that we still have today, the Camp David peace accords, that still govern the relationship between Egypt and Israel. Now, in 1978, because the Palestinians had been in Lebanon since 1970 after their expulsion from Jordan, and because they were launching a series of attacks on Israel, the Israelis decided to invade South Lebanon. And they took a small strip of territory, and then after a series of attacks, Ariel Sharon, the defense minister of Israel at the time, decided to launch a full-scale invasion of Lebanon that reached the capital, Beirut. This succeeded in forcing the Palestinians out of Lebanon. They went into exile in Tunisia, and it seemed that the avenues for Palestinian militancy were closed. Then two things happened. First, there was the Palestinian Intifada in 1987, where essentially protesters within the 1967 occupied territories began throwing stones at Israeli soldiers, launching strikes, doing their best to find a way of objecting to Israeli military government over their territory, or what they believe is their territory, the territory that they'd inhabited for hundreds of years, in some cases 2,000 years, 2,000 plus years. Remember, the Palestinians themselves are not just Arab invaders. There is Arab blood mixed into them, but they're also genetically quite Jewish and quite Canaanite, in addition to having that Arab influence and in addition to having converted to Islam over the hundreds of years of Islamic occupation of the Holy Land. So there was this Palestinian Intifada that really became a problem for Israel, that really embarrassed Israel politically. And the view from the Israeli side was that it would be better for the Palestinians to return to militancy because that would help justify the Israeli position better. In 1990, Iraq decides to invade Kuwait. And the leader of the Palestinians at the time, Yasser Arafat, decides that he's going to back Iraq because he believed this was the last Arab country that would support him. The Syrians he'd had terrible relations with since the Lebanese Civil War, and his position there wasn't tenable. Iraq was seen as the last state that he could bargain on. And it also helped that the Iraqis paid him $50 million in exchange for his support for their invasion of Kuwait. This backfired spectacularly. In 1991, the Americans just decimated the Iraqi army and kicked out the Iraqis from Kuwait, and Arafat found himself with zero backers. Then the Soviet Union had collapsed, and he was completely isolated. So what did he do? He made peace. The Palestinians and the Israelis negotiated a peace agreement that was supposed to lead to the establishment of a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, the territories that had most meaning for the Israelis, particularly the West Bank, because the setting of the Bible is mostly Jerusalem and the West Bank, places like Rachel's Tomb, places like Jericho, places like Hebron. These have enormous spiritual meaning for Jews and for Muslims, with Islam claiming to be the true heir of Judaism, and this became a problem. And let's watch this quick video about the Oslo Peace Accords and help sort of put them in context.
Preparations are underway. We expect to see the president shortly.
For what he called an historic and honorable compromise.
30 years ago, a hopeful moment in the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians.
It's a day for optimism.
Two sworn enemies arrived at the White House to sign a peace agreement.
The deal was struck in secret by the principal.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, a former general, represented Israel.
Have now agreed to lay down their guns.
Representing the Palestinians, Yasser Arafat, the chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization.
This is a historic breakthrough. Between Israel and the PLO, two national movements competing for the same space, and for the first time they're prepared to recognize each other.
Known as the Oslo Accords, supported by President Bill Clinton, it was designed to end years of violence by laying out a peace process, a deal that could give Palestinians their own state and land captured by Israel in the 1967 Arab-Israeli War.
President Clinton felt this was his baby.
It charts a course toward reconciliation between two peoples who have both known the bitterness of exile.
On the White House lawn, the tensions were visible.
To the last minute, there were issues. Rabin is insisting that Arafat can't come in anything that looks like a uniform. We're telling Arafat, you can't come with a, you don't bring a weapon. You know, he's always had a pissy. You don't bring a weapon to the White House.
Then at a point, the president looks at Rabin and he says, you're going to have to shake his hand. And Rabin looked like someone had punched him in the stomach, and he stood there for a moment. This is a man he considered a terrorist all his life.
And then the handshake. An image that would become iconic.
These hands that shook knew nothing but to shoot. The trigger, the bullets, the bombs, the fight. And the question to me is, can this handshake lead to the culture in the minds of Palestinians and Israelis that coexistence is possible, that peace is possible, to live and let live?
This is the Oslo Accord. It was meant to give the Palestinians a state, and for Yitzhak Rabin, the Israeli prime minister and defense minister who had been responsible for the signing of this accord, the aim was to create a state that was 80% Jewish. For the Israelis, the big fear was this. They wanted control over the West Bank for religious purposes and for strategic purposes. If you look at a map of Israel, it's an extremely tiny, narrow country with no strategic depth. And its strategic depth comes from holding the West Bank. The problem is that the West Bank came with an enormous number of Palestinians. And these Palestinians pretty much wanted always to end the State of Israel. This was the objective of the whole Palestinian militant movement, and indeed a lot of the political movements that animated the Palestinians. So if we look at a map here, you see that this is the West Bank, and the border of the West Bank is somewhat here. And this leaves Israel at its narrowest space, at its narrowest place, with around 8 kilometers of territory. So strategically, unless the Palestinian state was fully disarmed and was truly subservient to Israel, there was no prospect that the Israelis would accept it, because it meant that the minute that there was an invasion, 8 kilometers is absolutely nothing. The Israelis would be overwhelmed, their country would be cut in half, and they would be defeated. So this was the thinking at the time, and it obviously caused division within the Israeli society and within the Palestinian society. Now, on the Palestinian side, the reaction was, for the most part, terrorism. And so we saw a pretty long series of attacks. You can see some of them here. From 1993, when the peace accords were signed, through 1994, through 95, through 96, onwards, until an Israeli prime minister, Ariel Sharon, the same guy who'd invaded Lebanon in 1982, built a separation wall that completely put the two populations apart and that prevented the Palestinians from being able to access Israel. Before that, the borders were between the West Bank and Israel were largely open. It's just that the West Bank was subject to Israeli military rule, and Israel proper was subject to civilian rule. And so we see here one of, you know, the aftermath of one of these attacks. It was criminal. It was horrific. It mainly targeted civilians. If you look at the areas that were hit, it was markets, it was buses, it was civilian areas. The logic behind it was simply to say to the Israelis, absolutely no, we don't accept peace. And from the Israeli right, the reaction was not terrorism, for the most part. The reaction was political, obviously, because they had a functioning state and a functioning democracy, and there was growing opposition to the idea of giving this extremely valuable territory to Palestinians who would never actually accept the state of Israel as being legitimate. And indeed, the way that the PLO and Fatah, the organizations that represented the Palestinians, the way that they tried to sort of sell this was, we failed militarily, for now we have to accept a two-state solution. The subtext being, one day we will overwhelm the Jews and we will be able to defeat them. This always was part of the thinking of the Palestinians, even some of those in the so-called Palestinian peace camp, which was, you know, a bit of a misnomer. As these attacks on civilians by organizations like Hamas and the Islamic Jihad increased in Israel, it became harder and harder to justify the idea of a peace agreement. Then something cataclysmic happened in 1995. An Israeli gunman...
At 11:10 p.m., as an outcome of murderous criminal assassination attempt, the Prime Minister of Israel and the Minister of Defense, Mr. Yitzhak Rabin, passed away. He was hit by 3 bullets in his chest and his abdomen.
So the Israeli Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin, who had signed the Oslo Peace Accords and tried to figure out a way to end this conflict with the Palestinians under the illusions of the liberal moment that we could all live in peace together, he was shot. And he was shot by an Israeli who thought that Rabin was a traitor for agreeing to cede the West Bank and perhaps parts of Jerusalem to the Palestinians. It wasn't a Palestinian who killed him, it was an Israeli. And eventually, the Israeli right won the elections in 1996. There was a back and forth with a bunch of different elections. And then in 2000, Ariel Sharon, the gentleman that I had mentioned as the guy who invaded Lebanon, he becomes prime minister. And he becomes prime minister after going to the holiest place for Jews and for Muslims in Jerusalem. And by doing so, the Palestinians believed that he had desecrated the Temple Mount or the Dome of the Rock or the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Obviously, the original mound is, name is the Temple Mount. I mean, the Palestinians call it something different, but the actual name, this is where Solomon's Temple is supposed to have stood. This is the original Holy of Holies for the Jewish people. Since the Muslims occupied Jerusalem, they built two mosques there and they claim it as theirs. And when the Jews enter this space, the Palestinians simply go wild. And Ariel Sharon knew that. And as part of his election campaign in the year 2000, he went there and it triggered a mass uprising by the Palestinians, a second intifada. But unlike the first intifada, this was absolutely not peaceful. This was an insurgency in the West Bank, mixed with a bunch of terrorist attacks inside Israel. And the objective was to make the peace process fail. And this is an objective that was shared with the new Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon. So we end up in this situation where the two sides have tried war from military to military, and they've gotten pretty much nowhere. And the two sides have tried militancy. In Lebanon, it had succeeded, because although Israel occupied Lebanon from 1978, in the year 2000, it was forced to withdraw without signing any kind of peace agreement. And for the Palestinians, this became the new template. They became convinced that just as the militancy of the Lebanese, of Hezbollah, backed by Iran, had led to the expulsion of Israel from Lebanon, something similar could be done against the Israelis. And this is what animated Hamas, which has had a pretty long and deep relationship with Israel for a very long time. This is what convinced them that the way forward was more militancy. And they've been committed to this path since then. In 2005, Ariel Sharon, the same prime minister who had helped trigger the Al-Aqsa Intifada, or the Second Intifada, or whatever you want to call it, in 2000, decided that he was going to give up on Gaza, and decided that there were too many Palestinians in Gaza, so the Israelis had to separate from them. And this was a policy that was pursued both in Gaza and to a lesser extent in the West Bank. So here's what had happened. Even as the Israelis and the Palestinians were officially bound by a peace treaty that would lead to a Palestinian state in the West Bank, more and more Israelis, especially religious Jews, moved to the West Bank and tried to establish settlements there, both legal and illegal. Now, under international law, these are seen as illegal, but in reality, this is simply the right of conquest. The problem with the United Nations and all of the resolutions of the United Nations is that they don't recognize the basic reality that we are a conquering species, and that part of what we do is go and occupy land and colonize it and build it up for our children, and that involves kicking out the children of others. This is part of our nature. We've decided since the Second World War to stop recognizing that this is a part of our nature, but I find that to be extremely naive and extremely reckless. So anyway, the Israelis were focused, given that they couldn't fully control all of the West Bank and that they couldn't fully control Gaza, they were focused on controlling as much territory as possible that would give them security and that would protect them against both the Palestinians and other Arab groups, and that would enable them to solve the problems that they face militarily, because after the experience with the wave of suicide attacks targeting Israel, they didn't actually believe that a peaceful resolution was possible. They believed that the only way to govern was through strength, and that the only way they could keep their state was basically by imposing their military dominance on everybody in the region. This is, in a sense, also a little bit idealistic, because although we are a conquering species, for us to function, there must be some basis for peace that involves a level of trust and a level of a mutual legitimacy. I accept that this land is land that perhaps I covet and that one day I would like to take, but that right now it's occupied by someone else and I have to face reality and do some business with them while accepting that they covet my land and I covet theirs. So in a way, the Oslo Peace Accords were too idealistic, but the Israeli position was too militaristic. And the reason that it played out this way was because of the mutually exclusive claims of the two sides. Either these holy places are given by God to the Jews, or they are given by God to the Muslims. This is what underpins this conflict. There's a national element in that the Palestinians claim to be a separate nation from the other Arabs. I find that a bit questionable. They are civilizationally Arabs, regardless of the details of their ethnicity. They are civilizationally Muslim, more importantly. The difference between them and the Jordanians and the Syrians and the Muslim Lebanese isn't really substantial. So there is this national element, but underneath it all is the religious element. And for the Israelis, one of the paradoxes of Israel is this. As I said in the last episode, Israel was founded as a secular project. It was meant to be a national homeland for the Jewish people, not a religious return project. But as Jews lived in the land in ever greater numbers, due to the peculiarities of Israeli politics and due to the fact that more and more religious Jews migrated to Israel, and due to the fact that religious Jews have a much higher birth rate than secular Jews, the importance of religion in this conflict to the Jews increased very dramatically. So in a way, Itzhak Rabin, the guy who signed the peace agreement with the Palestinians, and his foreign minister, Shimon Peres, they were the last of the Israeli secular generation that saw Israel purely in nationalistic terms. And over time, the thinking of the Jewish population of Israel changed, and they began to see the country in much more religious terms. So for somebody who is a secular Jew like Rabin, it was conceivable to give the holiest territories in Israel to a hostile religion and a hostile national identity like the Palestinians.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.